This is one of our favorite outdoor explorers and has been edited to be replayed here today.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolford. Rarely do we walk on the beach on Kachemak Bay without coming back with rocks and shells in our pockets. The simple act of picking things up and learning about them can be a rich part of exploring the outdoors, adding depth and a sense of belonging to the place. Collecting is a deep urge for a lot of us. Of course, you have to do it ethically without harming the places we all love, so there's a bit to know about it too. We'll be talking about rock hounding today with folks who get serious about geology and finding specimens to keep, and we'll spend time with scientists who find real treasures, fossils, and ancient bones of animals that once lived in Alaska. I want to learn about all the weird creatures that lived here and the people who lived here in the past, why they were here, how paleontologists have put together that story and the archaeology. A lot to cover in 1 hour, and I've got some great guests to do it. In the first half here, David Yesner is with us. He's an archaeologist at UAA who studies bones and how they tell us about ancient humans that lived in Alaska. Thanks for being with us, David.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Bob Blodgett is here, too. He's a contract geologist and paleontologist who studies invertebrates. That's like shelled creatures primarily and things from the very, very distant past. Thanks for being with us, Bob.
Well, thank you, and it's a pleasure to be here with you.
I think that every kid in elementary school wants to be a paleontologist. I know I did, because these fossils are so fascinating and just so inspire your imagination. How did you become a paleontologist? I mean, what was that? What is it about it that sort of turned you on?
Well, I liked how you started the show about talking about beachcombing. I think at heart, I'm not a mountain climber or someone does rigorous athletic things, but I love to beachcomb. And when I'm down there, what do I like to pick up? Shells on the beach, seaweed, everything. And this is just extrapolating it, taking it into the past. It's a fabulous hobby, and in Alaska, we have a lot of opportunities up here to see geologic time and the coalition of the different terrains, see climate change in sections, which hopefully we can talk about later.
Yeah.
And we have a great workplace here that needs some more study because there's been so few boots on the ground to speak.
Yeah, and I mean, you've got a range of scientific papers in front of you showing some of these fossils that look like shells and things that you would find today, except that these were things that lived long ago. How long ago?
The stuff I study ranges roughly from about 450 million years ago up until about 16 million years ago. But I'm primarily in what's called the Paleozoic and the early Mesozoic. And my last project was over at Tuxedni Bay with the Park Service and assessing a fantastic section of Middle Jurassic fossils. It's so rich over there, that should be our Alaska's own Jurassic Park.
Yeah, so people don't realize that Alaska is a really rich area of fossils, and dinosaur bones have been found on the North Slope, and it's sort of not part of our image, right? But is this a really good place to look for fossils?
It's not so much in the Anchorage Bowl, but as you get into the Talkeetnas, there's a lot of sites. If you can get to the west side of Cook Inlet, we've got lots of sites. If you can fly to southeast Alaska, lots of stuff. And I should say, just when you mentioned dinosaurs, we've got lots of undocumented dinosaur sites. There's a book published in France in 1939. I'm sure you know about brontosaurs. There's actually a picture of a brontosaurus footprint, probably from the Alaska Peninsula. No one's ever been able to track the source of where that photo came from. I have an idea, but we've got a lot of things waiting to be found.
Yeah, I love the treasure hunt aspect of this.
And I think anybody can take this on and learn about this and become their own, you know, PI, private investigator in the subject.
Oh, great.
It's a fun hobby I recommend it to everybody.
I want to learn more about that, but I want to also talk to our other guest, David Yesner, who's an archaeologist and obviously talking about stuff that's much closer to the present, but still pretty far back in the past. How did you become an archaeologist, or what was the inspiration for you, and what is the inspiration for you now as you do your work?
Well, my earliest interest also went back to childhood, pretty early childhood. It was my parents who bought me a subscription to National Geographic, which kid growing up in Connecticut, I thought that was so much more fascinating than anything I observed around me, and the wonderful world of archaeology and these kinds of books. And at the same time, I was really interested in biology and specifically in animals. My dad was a physician, and I used to work in his labs in the summertime, and I ended up having a summer job working in an animal lab. And so eventually, I put those two things together. I put in my interest in anthropology and archaeology together with an interest in animals, and the result of it is is the particular specialty that I'm interested in, which is called zooarchaeology, which is the study of animal bones from archaeological sites. Although I will say that I have worked at purely paleontological sites too, ones like, for example, a cave out in the Pribilof Islands in St. Paul that holds answers to understanding something about humans and their role in in having a hand in or not having a hand in the extinction of some of these animals at the end of Ice Age time. So even the more purely paleontological sites that I've worked at have still had important implications for humans and our activities over the course of the last several thousand years.
You know, I think that people, outdoor people who are listening to our show, are used to going into the wilderness and having this feeling that, oh, I'm the first person here, right? That this is empty land and it's all wild and sort of we're explorers. And when you read about the white explorers who came here, 100 years ago, they had the same sense, even though there are natives everywhere who had already explored it all. And maybe the Alaska natives sometimes have that sense because they moved around a lot. But what your work shows that there are people everywhere, right? And that this land has been used for a long time.
Well, and actually the people that came before, the indigenous people, the Alaska Native people, were explorers themselves. They would occasionally dig up mammoth tusks or other fossilized remains that were deposited long before they got there and reuse them for various different purposes, or materials that earlier people had left behind and reuse them. And sometimes that confuses archaeologists on occasion, although dating methods that we use help to tease some of those things apart. So I would say the curiosity for discovery of one's own past and of things that have come before is certainly not something that's exclusive to white people coming into Alaska just in the last couple of hundred years, but it's something I think innate to everyone anywhere. And certainly scientists just take their own particular dimension to that innate human desire to explore and find out more about the past.
Uh-huh. Now, one of the things about archaeological resources is that, as I understand it, is the way that they are deposited or the way they're found can be very important to trying to tell the story of what happened there. And therefore, it's important that people who find archaeological resources don't disturb them and take things. Would you agree with that? And I mean, because we're talking today about collecting, and there's some things you can collect and some things you can't. So we need to make that clear.
Sure. The fancy term for that is context, archaeological context. It's the association, for example, of the animal bones with artifacts and features that are left behind by people often in a sealed fashion in a deposit. So it's the stratigraphy or layering in the ground and the exact position of materials relative to each other, along with dating methods and other things that we use that really help to unravel that story. Because without it, we've sort of got these disembodied, artifacts and bones and really can't use them effectively to put together a story. Of course, the principles of stratigraphy are true if you're using something that are hundreds of thousands or even millions of years old, as opposed to things that are only, decades or hundreds of years old. In fact, it's something that was taken from geology originally, which developed earlier in many ways back in the late 19th century. And we've used those techniques very effectively in mm-hmm. terms of being able to piece together.
So if somebody finds arrowhead or whatever it may be and takes it home and puts it on their wall, it's really lost a lot of meaning by doing that. And it's also probably breaking the law unless...
It is one of the exceptions that was made in the passage of the Archaeological Resources Protection Act in 1979 was for surface collecting of arrowheads. That was necessary in order to get that bill through Congress.
In other words, it's sitting there on the ground. You don't have to dig it up.
Well, and those things, of course, there's nothing that I often say to my students, there's nothing that's totally lost. It's informational based. There's still something you can glean even from the most disturbed mm-hmm. site in some ways. But obviously there are sites that are more disturbed than others, sometimes unfortunately through the activities of humans themselves and digging up their sites. We know sites here in Alaska that have been disturbed by treasure hunters or even by people in communities, you know, because they can get a lot of money from the sale sometimes of valuable items. But culture heritage and our understanding, a deeper understanding of what those things mean is obviously altered every time right. something like that takes place. And that's why these laws have been developed, because this is a heritage that belongs to all of us, and we need to preserve it for the past, just like it's part of the whole environmental protection, I think, mentality that really accelerated in the 60s and 70s. Mm-hmm. And that is, you know, we can't just think about our own generation, but have to think about those that are coming after
us. It belongs to everyone. You can't just right. take it. Yeah. yeah. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. We're talking today about rock hounding, fossils, archaeology, this aspect of the land that you can learn much more about the places where we're recreating, and it really enriches the experience. And I've got two scientists in the studio for this first half of the show talking about archaeology, David Yesner, UAA, a zooarchaeologist, and Bob Blodgett is a contract geologist and paleontologist who looks at very ancient fossils. Bob, we were just talking about how if you find cultural artifacts, you really should leave them where they are, and there's laws protecting them. There's sometimes if you find a fossil that it's okay to collect it. Talk a little bit about how folks can be ethical about their collection. You know, I spend my summers on Kachemak Bay, and we often find big pieces of petrified wood, which are really interesting and fun to pick up, and it doesn't seem to be harming anything. There's so much of it there. I don't think there's any law against that. What are the sort of the rules about gathering fossils?
I was brought in the initial phase when they're putting together the National Paleontological Act and participated in updates and things like that up until about 3 or 4 years ago. And my opinion is the invertebrates are not critical. Vertebrates are critical. You've got dinosaurs, you've got vertebrates. I don't like private collecting because the stuff is extremely rare. With invertebrates, in 99.9% of the cases, if you're going along a roadside outcrop or you see something on the beach, I have no issues with that. And I love to see people get amateur interest. But the good thing is, if you collect it, mark it down on a map where you got it. Take a GPS, keep it, and maybe when you move on or pass on, give it to a museum, a repository. We need the data that we find in Alaska often comes from interested amateurs. They've done a lot to find things here.
Because Alaska is so huge,
yeah,
right? There's
yeah.
a lot, you know, you
exactly.
can't cover it all.
But no, in general, I'd say the answer is vertebrate sites are protected. Invertebrates are pretty open. However, caveat is, you've got to be careful on whose land you are. There are land issues. If you're on park lands, you have to have a permit.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you're in the intertidal zone, then intertidal stuff is open to collecting. The other thing I think ethically I'd like to stress for invertebrate collectors, don't overcollect. There's no reason to mine it. We do have people up here who have gone in and mined sites, and that's just reprehensible.
And they just destroy it.
They
right.
destroy it, and it puts it in a Quonset hut, and it disappears.
I won't
name names, but I think even he knows what I'm talking about.
Yeah. What's the those big curving shells called? That people will put, you know, that really are impressive looking.
Ammonites.
Yeah.
Ammonites.
And that's sort of the thing that everybody's after, right?
Yeah. Those are the most popular items. And there are people here who have made a lifetime without pay collecting ammonites all over the state, including some geologists. And why collect it to ad nauseum, you know?
Right.
And some don't even put it on display. They wind up in a, like I said, a Quonset hut. I won't
right.
say where.
There's this drive that we have to find something, you know.
Yeah.
So the treasure hunt aspect, and then the collecting thing comes out of that a little bit.
But a lot has been found by amateurs and mm-hmm. interested amateurs. I think it's fabulous. But please note where it comes from.
Right.
And if you see something that's neat, go to a professional and ask them their opinion.
Right.
And if something is endangered, then I think on a case-by-case basis, state or other agencies should step in and make a site protected so that it's mm-hmm. not destroyed. But for invertebrates, not so critical. Vertebrates, I'd say, don't go there.
If I find a dinosaur, it's not yours.
Yeah. Right. Or even a tertiary mammal or,
uh-huh.
or a fish, for instance. If you found a fish bed, then there are one or two known up here.
we have so little data.
Yeah.
So it's critical.
So tell me about what are the primary sites that you're studying or have studied where you find fascinating stuff and what excites you about what your I mean, everything excites you about your work. But
well, I'm working now with the Park Service over on the west side of Cook Inlet, and there's a place called Tuxedni Bay.
Mm-hmm.
It was one of the first places ever that invertebrates were noted in the state, discovered by Russians. A man named Peter Doroshin found it in 1848. They were published in a Russian journal in 1871. And we're working with his material. We're working with his sections and fossils. And now we've contacted the Russian Museum in St. Petersburg, and they're sending photos of his specimens. So we're going to keep updating this work and put the Russian specimens next to the Russian illustrated forms, plus our new collections. And you can find this stuff. In fact, we're leading a field trip for the Alaska Geological Society, and we've got about 8-9 people interested in going over in a boat to us to walk through the section.
That's really exciting.
And they get to collect, and the collections will go to the Park Service. And I will put a plug in for the Park Service. They have been doing the most vivid proactive work in supporting paleontology in the state. So toss my hat off tip it to them. They have really been a major source of support, at least from my point of view. I don't know, David.
It seems like they publicize it well, too.
Yeah.
So in terms of what you're looking at, one of the things that I've found really interesting, and I think a lot of people find surprising, is that the Alaska has changed so much from the distant past. And when we talk about dinosaurs, obviously it had to have been a lot warmer for reptiles to be here.
Oh, yeah.
What do you learn from these fossils that you're looking at?
Well, for the invertebrates, even matching with the invertebrates in the Jurassic, we had a tremendous global climate change up here that is more intense than anything I think we've seen, even imagine modern times. We even had subpolar conditions in the late Jurassic. Things went down to cold, whereas in the early middle Jurassic, when these were subtemperate, mm-hmm. cooled down drastically, biodiversity just plunged, and you have conditions similar to the modern Arctic. And you can see this, and it's a great place, and we want to do isotope studies with seashells. There's so much that can be done up here.
Right.
And then you get the plate tectonic aspects. Alaska's a collage or thing of all these different terrains that have come in by seafloor spreading, plate tectonic processes. And so it's kind of as someone called it, kind of the graveyard of the North Pacific. And it's just fun to study the individual terrains, these parts
we call
of the Pacific.
Terrains, these are these pieces of land that sort of work their way across the Pacific plate as it's spreading from the center. It's
right.
a conveyor belt. It's moving pieces of land, and then they kind of collide with what's
right.
already here.
Some coming from the south, some coming from the north, some rotating, and mm-hmm. it's just colliding.
What an amazing puzzle for you to figure out, because you've got changing climate through time, and
right.
you've also got changing location.
Very complex. Yeah. You're right.
Yeah.
You hit the nail on it.
And also, through time, you've got evolution, and so the creatures are changing. So it sounds like it's putting together this vast mosaic of puzzle
right.
pieces.
There's a terrain in southeast Alaska called the Alexander Terrain, and that's my hobby. I've been putting several books together on the how Alaska formed, but this is on the paper we did on the Alexander Terrain. And the fossils.
And terrain is a word that people probably are unfamiliar with, T-E-R-R-A-N-E.
Yeah, it's a tectonic term,
right.
not terrain as in the landscape.
Right, right.
But it's interesting, the fossils we're getting out of the Alexander Terrain of southeast Alaska have Northeast Russian postage stamps on them. They came from Northeast Russia. They're not part of North America. This stuff probably broke off during a rifting event in the Devonian. And it's piled in here, probably in the Jurassic. This stuff comes across the Pacific, then moves back up, as you mentioned, with all this stuff coming from the south to the north. And here we're sitting with these Russian postage stamps and how they get there. And we got to still work out the details of what the intermediate age rocks are doing. But
this is land that's actually sort of presently located kind of in the middle of Alaska?
Well, southeast.
Yeah.
This is Prince of Wales Island, and you can go down there. And this is a great place for amateurs. There's a road system that is fantastic. You can drive all over the place.
Prince of Wales is really an interesting place to visit. And a lot of great hiking trails and cabins you can stay in and caves we've talked about.
Oh, yeah.
That you can. The Forest Service will take you down in these deep caves. So, yeah. So when you the stories that you're telling about the past are a lot related to where you happen to have topography where fossils are uncovered, right? So where like in Anchorage, where there's deep soil, there's no story to tell because you can't find any fossils.
Yeah. Our closest fossil sites of easy access to Anchorage, well, I can say go to Eagle River, but that's pretty tough to walk down the Eagle River itself at the banks by the bridge that crosses there. But go up to Chicoloon. And near Chicoloon, there's tertiary, very early tertiary plant beds. And in these plant beds, you can get ginkgos and cycads and palm leaves. Quite a different climate, more like Florida.
Wow.
That's only 60 million years, right? There was a very interesting warming period at the Paleocene-Eocene boundary. And so you've got this plethora of warm water things and then things before, I mean, warm weather things before it was cool, before it was, you know, cool again. And, of course, now we live in subpolar conditions by comparison.
So you can go in sort of in the rocks, see palms.
Yeah. So you can work. Alaska's a great place to do paleoclimate studies from the past using fossils, whether they're plant, animal, you know, whatever, microfossils, vertebrates, but also use geochemistry and a lot of other indices. And you have tremendous aptitude up here. And we've seen even these polar dinosaurs in the Cretaceous people talk about. That was supposedly about 80 degrees north. How in the heck are these dinosaurs living at 80 degrees north?
It's amazing.
Farther north, there's, what, 70 now, the sites, and they're at 80. The sunlight has been a big issue. And yet the foliage and the vegetation, there speaks of a much warmer influence. Not tropical, not even subtemperate, but, I mean, some people argue these things are moving from the south and the north, and they're migratory. But
just makes you realize what a complex and fascinating world we live in. I want to turn back to our other guest, David Yesner, who's an archaeologist, and what are the sort of the most interesting sites you're working on right now, and what are kinds of things that you're trying to learn?
Well, let me paint a picture for you of a few different sites that really illustrate, I think, the most important use of these kinds of studies to inform us about the relationship between humans and our larger world. Again, global environmental change is not something that's new. It's an important driving force in natural history and in human history. And so sort of in order of time depth, we worked for 20 years at a site called Broken Mammoth in interior Alaska, about 20 miles north of Delta Junction, which contains some of the best preserved evidence of animal bones from the late Ice Age and in association with human artifacts and features and so on. And we have ongoing analysis of the mammal, bird, and a little bit of fish material that are associated with that site. But they really revealed the nature of the very rapid climate change that took place at the end of Ice Age times and how humans accommodated themselves to a world in which the mammoths and horses had recently disappeared and they were targeting bison and elk and various other species and waterfowl and fish and so on in a very rapidly changing and transforming world, and even giving us clues to how sort of humans organize themselves to do that. So that's an example of one project that...
And that's something I find so interesting because it gives us, I mean, we're obviously living in a climate change now, one that's maybe happening faster than any in the past because of the carbon dioxide humans are emitting and so forth. And our culture will change. I mean, are you able to look at how cultures were affected by these changes in the past?
Sure, because we have the evidence sort of from before and after, and we can raise issues about the nature of climate change here as opposed to other parts even of the Arctic and how that differentially impacted people and how they responded to it with changes in their hunting styles and the way they organize themselves on the landscape and all those kinds of things. And you're right, there are analogs that you can develop between these things, between modern climate change and ancient climate change, that are, you know, that are very useful. And I think those are the kinds of things we need to tell the public about, because that's the kind of information that they need to get out of, you know, their well spent tax dollars that are spent on the kinds of work that we do.
Right. So, well, I mean, when I was working in the Arctic, and I found it really interesting that there was this, you know, major climate change that had taken place that had really caused, Inupiaq people, they weren't called that yet, to change their hunting habits. And looking at what they conserved culturally was whaling. They continued to whale even though they had to change all their practices because Little Ice Age created, you know, more ice and made it more difficult. And so I started thinking about, like, well, what are we going to conserve if things change for us, right? You know, and I wonder, do you think it's valid to make those kind of comparisons?
Sure, absolutely. I think you gain great insights from doing that kind of work. And so because Alaska has been in the past and continues to be a kind of a bellwether place for looking at climate change, so we're on the front of that, and that was no different in the past than in the present. We often have made the mistake in the past of thinking it's kind of an unchanging Arctic area, but it's anything but. And I think that project that I just described, a recent project with my wife, Chris Crossan, in the geology department here in looking at sea mammal bones recently revealed by the recession of the Bering Glacier, these things dating from 9 to 13,000 years ago to the end of Ice Age times and telling us what resources might have potentially been available for coastal migrants to have targeted. That's paleontological site. Or our discovery of the last of mammoths in North America out in the Pribilof Islands that I mentioned in a cave site out there, which, you know, is really key to understanding the whole processes of animal extinction and how much humans had a role in it. They're only 5,700 years old, half the distance from the Ice Age
mammoths
to the present.
Are still around 5,000 years ago.
And wow. They were out in those islands in the middle of the Bering Sea.
Isn't that weird? Yeah.
That's it. But it's there's only one place where they lasted later, and that's out on Wrangel Island off of northeast Russia. And then finally, you know, dealing with things that are really much more part of the modern world, and that is looking at what's been happening with human-animal interactions over the last couple hundred years. I was involved with a project with Aaron Kroll of the Smithsonian Office on the outer Kenai coast, looking at changes in seal and sea lion populations and how they might have been affected by recent climate change with recession of glaciers, and then working with Fran Seeger-Boss out in the Mat-Su Borough on working at sites that date from the Russian period through the Gold Rush and looking at the complete shift away from caribou hunting, which was what people, native people, were doing here 200 years ago, to moose hunting. They're the Johnny-come-latelys. They really replaced caribou in this area, and understanding even that you can use archaeological data, zooarchaeological data, for getting at not just stuff that's 10,000 or 15,000 years old, but looking at much more recent climate change and using the fine scale resolution that archaeologists have for really getting at, you know, how these potential human resources have been changing and how human societies have responded just over. And so that's very contemporary kind of issues that are being addressed there.
Fascinating. And I hope that, you know, we've inspired listeners in terms of the fact that when you're crossing the Alaskan landscape that we love so much, there's so much information buried in it, right? There's so much there that tells us about the past if you know how to look at it. So.
Correct. I think that these scientific studies do more than anything else. They open your eyes to the world that you're walking through and didn't notice these things. And all of a sudden, you know, it's like coloring the canvas. These things become available to your intellect in a way that they hadn't
and
before.
And really makes the experience so much more rich. Well, I want to thank both of my guests here for the first half. David Yesner, a zooarchaeologist from UAA. And Bob Blodgett, a contract paleontologist, geologist. Thanks to both of you very much for being
thank
with
you
us.
Thanks very much.
We're going to take a quick break now. In the summer of 2013, Museum of the North curator Pat Druckenmiller was floating the Yukon with some colleagues when they stumbled upon thousands of dinosaur tracks. Reporter Emily Schwing in Fairbanks has more on that discovery.
Down this aisle right here.
Pat Druckenmiller leads the way past shelves of specimens in the basement of the Museum of the North. There are whale skulls, giant bones, and at the end of one dimly lit row, huge chunks of sand and mudstone.
So this is some of what we collected. There's one for starters.
Those are huge.
He balances a giant tan-colored rock on his knee.
Yeah, totally.
So this is three toes of a medium-sized meat-eating dinosaur, possibly a small tyrannosaur, and you can even sometimes, right here, you can see the impression of the actual claw.
It looks exactly as one might expect a three-toed dinosaur footprint to look. This is one of thousands of preserved dinosaur tracks Druckenmiller and colleagues discovered this summer.
This and all the other material we found was just a total, complete surprise, because no one expected anything like this was out there.
The team put their boats in on the Yukon River at the village of Ruby and floated all the way to Caltech. Druckenmiller says part of the surprise is that no one in any of the villages they passed along the way knew what was hidden in the riverbanks.
I find it hard to believe that somebody didn't see these before, and maybe they didn't call them dinosaurs, but somebody must have found some very you know, convincing footprints that made them wonder.
Research into the area's geology led some of Druckenmiller's colleagues to believe they might find something.
So they're Cretaceous age rocks from the age of the dinosaurs, about 90 to 100 million years old. And the cool thing is they had a lot of plant fossils, leaves from broadleaf trees and different types of conifers. In other places where we found tracks, this is a great combination of things to expect to find tracks. So, sure enough, we said, let's go give it a try.
And the effort paid off. Other evidence of dinosaurs has been discovered along the Colville River on the North Slope and at Denali National Park. But Druckenmiller says these Yukon River fossils are 25 to 30 million years older.
And that's interesting because we know that climatically that was a warmer period in Earth history. Alaska was still farther north than it is today, so that these dinosaurs that we find on the Yukon River were living above, at or above the Arctic Circle when they were alive. And so that's really cool. And because they're older than the other tracks in the state, we get a sense of how dinosaurs changed through geologic time.
The discovery includes both meat-eating and plant-eating dinosaurs. Druckenmiller
really
pulls
one out
another specimen.
Oh, wow. You can see that one really nicely. These are footprints of ankylosaurs, which are plant-eating dinosaurs that were armored dinosaurs. They were covered in these little bony plates all over their back and shoulders and head. They have a very distinctive kind of footprint. The hind foot, like this one here, has four toes, and the tracks are generally wider than long. And then the front foot has five toes, and they're about as long as they are broad.
He can identify some of the footprints based on bones collected from elsewhere in the state.
In some cases, we really don't know what the track maker was. And in fact, we have a couple of very strange footprints that we're still investigating and we think might be really exciting when we figure out what they are.
But he wouldn't elaborate. He says a new find like this is extremely rare in the 21st century.
It's really like doing paleontology as it might have been done 100 years ago anywhere else in the world, where you would go out and you'd be the first person to step and walk onto land and really look at it as a paleontologist and say, wow, you know, what kind of fossils are preserved in this? So it's exciting to be able to still do that in a place like Alaska.
The team has many years' worth of work ahead before they can fully tell the story of the dinosaurs that lived along the Yukon River. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on KSKA Anchorage. The program repeats tonight at 9 o'clock on FM 91.1. Connect with Outdoor Explorer anytime. Download podcasts and see what's coming up on future programs by going to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. I'm Charles Woolforth, and today we're talking about rock hounding and fossils and all these underground things in Alaska and that open up the place that you're recreating in and make it more interesting. And then in this half of the show, we're going to talk about just the recreation of gathering and collecting things on your own. It's quite a hobby, and there's quite a bit to it. I'm just as we've been getting ready for the show, I've been learning about it. In the studio, we have Philip Elliott, who is with the Matsu Rock and Mineral Club. And on the phone from Montana is Montana Hodges, who is at the University of Montana getting her PhD in paleontology. And she's also the author of the book, Rock Hounding Alaska. And welcome to both of you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
So, Philip, tell me about what is the drive? What's the energy behind rock hounding? I mean, what sort of turns you on and gets you excited about it?
I think the thing that I like the most is that it gets me out doing all the things that I enjoy. I like to get out in the outdoors. I like to hike. I like to fish. I like to camp.
I like to search for things. Growing up, I looked for arrowheads as a child. I found my first arrowhead when I was 2 years old with my mom, and it just kind of grew from there. My mom always threw that out there that, you know, you should keep your eyes open and look around at your world and see what there is. And this is one of those things that really allows you to do that. You get to search for things. It's like a every summer Easter egg hunt that, you know, you find neater and neater things. Some things are really unique to Alaska. Some things are all over the world, and you might find a good or okay specimen. But there are some really neat items up here that you can look for, and you don't have to have all the equipment. People always ask me, you know, what do I need to have? And usually it's just a desire to go out and look for things, and a rock hammer. You know, you just go out and enjoy yourself.
So what kind of things are you looking for when you go on one of these? And you do outings with the group, right, with the Matsu?
Yes, yeah, with the Matsu Club, and I also am a member of the Chugach Gem and Mineral Society here in Anchorage.
And we'll have links on our website, so folks can go to alaskapublic.org, and there'll be links for our previous guest, too, the scientist we had in the studio, and you can just find links to everything we're talking about if you want to learn more.
Right.
But go ahead,
right.
Philip.
So, yeah, we go and we look for everything, fossils and we look for ammonites and plant fossils. There's plant fossils just right up in Sutton that we can go up and look for. There's amber up there that we have one of our members goes up with a black light in the evenings and looks for amber with the black light because it just pops out of the soil. We go and look for geodes and thunder eggs
What are those?
Geodes are basically a cavity in rock that will form. Minerals will form inside of them, and so we'll go up in the mountains and pull out these things, these rocks that have all kinds of crystals and a lot of quartz, a lot of calcite in them. And they're when you find them way up in the mountains, they are perfect. They're pristine. They haven't tumbled down the mountain and been smashed up. And that's kind of an important thing. Everybody wants to see this beautiful thing, and it's hard to find when it's down the stream and being washed around. Uh-huh. So certain things, agates and jaspers, if they're in the stream, it's fine. They get tumbled around. It's no big deal. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you go up and you look for those crystals, and it's a lot more interesting to see something and gratifying to find something that is perfect.
Sounds like it's something good to do with a group the first time, because a lot of these mineral names you're using, I would have no idea what they even mean.
Right,
I wouldn't know what I was looking for.
Right, and that is one of the big benefits about joining the club is that we're able to, as a group, go up and some of us are in our club are geologists, some are surveyors. We all just have different backgrounds that we bring to it, and so. And then some of us are like me. I'm a total amateur. I am a carpenter. And so this to me is just something that I enjoy. I tend to get on the computer and look up things and try and find out better sources or accesses, that kind of thing. Access up here obviously is very limited. And so that's another nice thing in a group is that you can take people out there and say, okay, you know, here's where you go to look for these things. And here's a safe way to get there and not safe way. Because that's another aspect of this is that you want to go out and be safe. You want to come home in the same condition you came home in, but with better rocks.
Right.
And so, yeah, it's important to get out there and go as a group just for safety, but also, you know, the enjoyment of camaraderie and sharing something with other people.
Does it cost anything to go with one of these rock hounding groups?
No.
With the clubs?
No. There is a fee with the rock hounding group just to join the club, but it's really nominal.
Right.
And that's all all that information is there on the website. But that's, like I said, it's nominal, and it's...
You're just getting in with a group of like-minded people are going to probably be very excited about helping you to do
exactly,
it.
Exactly.
So easy activity to get involved with.
Very easy. Yeah. And like I said, you don't really have to have anything special to go out and look for these things. Not even a rock hammer, particularly. Mm-hmm. That's kind of your most basic tool, and if you have one, great. But really, we go look
looking for something cool on the ground.
Yeah. We go and do trips just up on the rivers, and you know, pull rocks out of the rivers that are interesting and unique, and throw them in the yard, and people admire them and ooh and all over them. And so, yeah,
if it looks cool, it's worth collecting.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So let me get our other guest, Montana Hodges, on the. How did you get interested in this activity? You wrote the book Rock Hounding Alaska. You were a travel writer at the time, but now you're learning to be a paleontologist. What excited you about this this sort of area of the world?
Well, my background's in geology, so I have a double bachelor's where I studied geology and journalism. And one of the things that I always looked at with rock hounding is this is a great opportunity for science education. You know, it's a treasure hunt, but you can also learn just a multitude of things about earth science while you're out there. And so I look at rock hounding sort of as a way to introduce people to the sciences, to earth science particularly, and geology. So you get kids out there and you start talking about fossils and they're picking up 200 million year old rocks and you get to talk about geologic time and all this exciting stuff. So I was really interested in getting a book out on rock hounding because I wanted to make sure that that science education was shared.
So in the book you kind of talk about, yes, it looks cool, but also here's the story about how it was created and what it means.
Right, and you don't necessarily need a book to do that. You can get on the internet, you can go with a rock club, and you'd be amazed at, I mean, people aren't just going treasure hunting, they are also really into the science. So it's very exciting to go out there and to find out a little bit about the earth around you. I mean, there's some amazing rocks around Anchorage and Alaska in general.
What are some of the more interesting spots? And we'll get Philip in on this too. It sounds like Sutton, Chickaloon, that area up the Glen Highway is pretty interesting. Montana, do you have some favorite areas that you like to go?
You know, if we're just talking up the Glen Highway, boy, Slide Mountain. Oh, that's amazing. I mean, there's all kinds of, I mean, a state 2.5 times the size of Texas. You guys have a lot going on. Even if you wanted to stay pretty close to Anchorage, you could look for things like gold. You know, you could go gold panning. So you can collect minerals as well as fossils. I mean, there's so much. Whatever your flavor is, really.
Yeah, and you list some of those spots in the book?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. There's 75 sites, and these are all highway sites.
Okay.
So, you know, they might require a couple of miles hiking in or something like that, but most of these aren't bush sites. So
right.
When you get in with your rock club and you're in that group, you can go out there and really explore. But I tried to keep it to things that are fairly accessible for the average person or family.
Mm-hmm. Well, Philip, I would assume that it's kind of like fishing, that if you fish right along the road, there's probably going to be a lot less in the stream. If you hike up off the road a little bit, you're probably going to do a bit better.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yep.
Right. Yeah. And I recommend you go with that group and you go with that club when you're going to take those big hikes. So.
Yeah. Anytime you get farther out, you're going to find better stuff because it's less picked over. There's, you know, when you have places like down in Washington where I grew up, that is a well-known site for carnelian, for example, you know, the reddish agates, they're well picked over. You know, everybody knows they're there and they get a lot of traffic. You get, you know, 15, 20, 30 miles back, and all of a sudden stuff starts popping out. Mm-hmm. And that's very true for up here, especially because there's so little access to so much of our state that it's hard to get to some of these really far back places. So we'll take four-wheelers and then we'll, you know, go 30 miles back on the wheeler and then a 5-mile hike after that. And you find really great stuff. So,
yeah, I'm just thinking about the fact that, that we think of Alaska being covered with vegetation, but there's plenty of places where the mountains are uncovered, and thinking particularly about how that great Kennecott copper mine was found and that the prospectors thought that there was going to be a place that was, they're going to be able to feed their horses because it
right.
was green.
Green
it turned
grass,
out it was
yeah.
green because it was full of copper. Right,
right, exactly.
So it's totally exposed and sitting right there on the surface.
Exactly. And there's a lot of that up here where, you know, you get above the tree line, which is not difficult to do. Down in Washington, again, you know, you go up you have to go up many thousands of feet to get above the tree line. And here mm-hmm. you only have to go up maybe a couple thousand feet. And you're up in the tundra and there's always the rock slides. Slide Mountain, for instance, you know, there's a big slide on there where it's just free and clear of vegetation still. And there's many places like that up here where you don't have to go too far back to find a great spot because it's exposed itself.
And where's Slide Mountain located?
Slide Mountain is up past
144?
Yeah, up past
144?
Yeah, up past Eureka. Yeah.
Okay. So, Montana, it's also important to be aware of who owns the land that you're on, right? I mean, I know you've worked with the Park Service a little bit. Give us a little bit of a primer on that topic.
Right. So, you know, I think it's always important to contact your potential land managers before you go. I think you guys already went over a little bit about fossil collecting and the difference between vertebrate and invertebrate, which can be really confusing for people. You know, basically don't collect the bones on public land. And also, if you're in a national park or state park, you don't want to collect anything. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the most important thing to remember. But you can always contact the land managers in advance, and they're happy to talk to you.
And you need to know where you're at.
Right.
Basically,
and
whenever
GPS,
you're doing anything outdoors.
I mean, kids have GPS on their cell phones. Just take a kid with you. You know, it's pretty easy to figure out.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And then when we talk about cultural resources, pretty much, I think probably the safest thing to do is to say it's a no-go zone. I mean, except some very exceptional circumstances. If you find cultural, that is human-based archaeological stuff, you just leave it where you found it.
Right.
You agree with that? Yeah. All right. So I want to hear about some of the coolest stuff you guys have found. Maybe start with you, Philip. But what is it when you're out rock hounding, what are you really looking for? What's going to actually, you know, light you up?
I think some of the things that we have enjoyed the most up here, I have a little bit of a list here because there's so many places that we've gone, and I've only been up here active in the group for about 5 years. And some of the my favorite places we've gone are up by Chicken. There are really great calcite crystals up there. There's labradorite and stuff that's right off the road system. You don't have to go back very far to find some of this stuff. Boulder Creek, just right up out of Chicoloon, has jaspers and agates. And then you get way up into the passes, and there's actually thunder eggs up there, which a thunder egg is a very specific geologic formation that's volcanic in origin. And Oregon is famous for thunder eggs, and what they are is a void in rhyolite, which is a type of solidified lava, and you'll find these thunder eggs that are up there, and they're in very specific locations. There's beds of them where you'll go and find these round rocks, and you can either break them open or cut them open, and you'll find agates and crystals and all kinds of stuff inside. And usually they're like the size of a softball or so. And when you see them for sale, especially out of Oregon, they're usually about that size, baseball to softball. And we've got some up there that we found that are over 3 feet in diameter.
Wow.
Yeah. And so it's really unique finding these things. They're so big, and some of them are hollow to where the earth forces have broken them apart, and now the crystals inside are exposed. Mm-hmm. And it's really fascinating going up there and seeing that.
So if you find one that's not broken, how do you know that that's what it is?
A lot of time and a lot of effort and looking at what people find.
Huh?
Yeah, that's it. And like I said, you know, that's one of the biggest benefits of going up with a group who knows what you're looking for, is that you see this ugly round rock and you think, whoop-de-doo.
So what? Yeah.
And then you cut it open and here's reds and pinks and blues you know, quartz crystals and all kinds of cool
stuff.
That
sounds really exciting.
It is very cool. It's very cool. And that, in that respect, it really is like an Easter egg hunt, you know, uh-huh. where you're looking for eggs. And that's a really great thing up here. I've looked online, and there's a lot of thunder eggs for sale. There are people who collect thunder eggs, that's what they do. And for them to see that there's Alaska thunder eggs is very exciting to them because they don't even know anything about Alaska.
Uh-huh.
And so I've had a lot of collectors, you know, I've posted pictures and stuff on Facebook and that kind of thing. And people are just astounded that those things are up here and that they are in such abundance. They have no idea.
Yeah.
So, and every place is unique. Each thunder egg bed is unique to its own area. So they can, there are people who can look at a thunder egg and say, oh yeah, that is from this spot. Particularly. And so to show them one from Alaska, they're like, well, I have no idea where that's from because I've never seen one like that.
Oh,
it was
cool.
Pretty fun. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess there's the really good activities are ones where you keep learning as
yes.
you go and you never stop, right?
Yeah.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and we're talking about rock hounding with Philip Elliott, and who is with the Matsu Rock and Mineral Club, and Montana Hodges, who's the author of Rock Hounding Alaska and is a PhD candidate at University of Montana. Montana, let me. I'm going to hit you with a question that might not be fair, but you do have a geology background. What causes these thunder eggs? I mean, I think everybody's seen one where it's sort of a round rock with sort of this inside, like thing of all these weird, interesting crystals. What causes that to come into existence?
You know, I might actually defer to Phil on that one because I'm not sure about the particular thunder eggs in Alaska. I have a pretty interesting story where I never found them when I went out looking for them.
Oh, really?
Yes.
You got skunked, huh?
Yeah, there's not a single picture of one in the book.
Oh, no. So when you wrote the book...
I'm not even sure what formation they're in, actually.
So when you were writing the book, you were kind of learning about rock hunting and doing it yourself, huh?
Right, yeah. It took me 3.5 years of traveling around to find 75 legal and safe sites for people to easily go to, which are the guidelines for the falcon bugs. As a geologist in Alaska, traveling around and working there, it's really exciting, and there's so much going on within the state. But I'm not sure about the formation of the thunder eggs. Phil, do you know?
They're a very volcanic rock. They form in, like I said, rhyolitic ash beds. There's a lot of really technical detail because it is a very specific formation. Many people get thunder eggs and geodes confused or think that they're the same thing, and they're not. Thunder eggs are very specific to a certain set of variables. It has to be within a certain rhyolitic formation, and as they form, they're formed a certain way. And I won't go into all the details that I've read. I've read a tremendous amount because I have a tremendous interest in this stuff. But they are a very unique formation, and when you see one, you know it. And it is amazing that each place, because of the mechanics of the weathering and the material, the silicas and coppers and all those things that are coming and weathering out of the surrounding rocks, they all add to the thunder egg, sometimes in different colors, sometimes in different materials that's within that thunder egg. Sometimes you'll have a lot of calcite, sometimes you'll have a lot of agate. It just really depends on how much time they were being formed and where they were formed and all that. So,
you know, Montana, as I listen to Philip here, I'm thinking, he says he's just a carpenter, but he should have a PhD in self-educated geology.
Yeah,
here.
That's what the rock clubs are like. They're absolutely amazing. I mean, you go out and you learn so much with these people. I mean, they're incredibly enthusiastic and together as a group. I mean, everyone has something to contribute.
Uh-huh. So did you, when you were working on the book and doing your rock hunting, did you have certain things that you were really excited about finding or things that you thought were super cool that you found?
I think the traveling across the state is probably one of the most amazing things that someone can do. I think for me, the ultimate rock hunting adventure was the Dalton Highway, which for Alaskans, if they haven't gone out there and done that yet, I think that's an incredibly important place to go. And
I am so with
you
on that. Yeah, we should do
a
show on that.
Rock hunting paradise. I mean, talk about rocks being exposed along that road. You can go from everything from giant quartz crystals, gold panning, to an amazing fossil reef in the Brooks Range that is just nearly touching the road. So Galbraith Lake and Attigan Pass, you have some, and I'm, of course, partial to fossils since that's what I study, but you have some amazing 350-million-year-old reefal fossils there, so corals.
And where is that? Where is that located, the fossils?
That it's in between Attigan Pass and Galbraith Lake. There's several exposures, not too far off the Dalton. You maybe walk about a mile, but it's tundra. It's a short mile.
Well, and people don't realize that north side of the Brooks Range, the walking is so easy, right? I mean, it's like walking
through
a park.
It's much easier up there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's nothing
in
the way.
It's not as bad as it is in the soggy areas in the south. But, I mean, that is an ultimate adventure in my mind. You could take a week and just rock hound alongside the road. You don't have to, for the average person who's not a backpacker or who, doesn't have their bush plane available or something, that's a roadside journey that I highly recommend.
And it's an adventure that Alaskans should do because it's unbelievable how beautiful it is up there and how much there is
absolutely
to see. Yeah, yeah.
We actually
I've driven it 4 times and it's not enough.
Uh-huh.
We actually have a when we get together and do our meetings for the rock club and I write the trip list for our club. We talk about, what's up and coming, what, we're going to do in the following years as well. And we actually had talked about doing a trip up there along the Dalton Highway and for next year. Mm-hmm. And spending, a week. I'm definitely not averse to spending a week or two in a place. Last year, I spent 10 days, 30, 40 miles out in the wilderness, out on my own with my brother.
Wow.
And Yeah, so that's actually funny you guys are talking about that, because that's somewhere we actually have a plan on going.
So when you're going out with a group like that, I mean, that's quite a bit of organization, right?
It is.
To go out for an extended camping trip with a big group of people.
Yeah, there's a lot of logistics to it. You know, just contacting people, making sure that everyone knows where to meet and all that. But it actually flows pretty well. We have a pretty good system to where, you know, if anything happens, you know, we'll call people and say, hey, this is a change. Several years ago, we were supposed to go up to Little Nelchina River out of Eureka, and somebody was up there a little bit early and called us up and said, hey, don't bother coming because the water too high and we're not going to cross this. And so it was really nice to have that and able to call people and say, hey, you know, this is the details, you know, we're not going to be able to do this. And so we changed it. We just went somewhere else and we had a great time. So yeah, logistics is definitely a big item for us.
And what do you do with the stuff after you find it? I mean, it sounds like you find way more stuff than you could possibly all display in your house, right? Just keep like the best stuff in your house, then
pretty much.
Can you sell the rest of the stuff, or what do you do with it?
You can't. There are laws about what you can sell and what you can't, as far as what's found on private property and public property and all those kinds of things. And so, yeah, you have to do, you know, adhere to those laws, obviously. But as far as for most of us collectors, we give away a lot of stuff at the clubs. We always have door prizes and things like that. And so we'll always, you know, give out little, you know, things to for door prizes and whatnot, so that other people can, you know, see it. We do have occasional auctions at our club where, you know, some of the proceeds will go to the club itself. So, yeah, we actually, my mom and my family and I were getting into lapidary, cutting and polishing of rocks, and we're buying a whole bunch of equipment. We probably just purchased $3,000 or $4,000 worth of equipment in the last couple months to be able to, you know, cut and polish these stones. And that way, you know, you can give them out as Christmas gifts and just enjoy them, you know.
So. I assume that probably your the club gatherings, you probably spend a lot of time showing off and one-upping each other.
I have no idea. My brother and I are the two biggest because both of us are of a size and an ability, an age that we can really go out and collect some really unique things. Yeah. And so it's a lot of fun. It's neat showing people what they can find and seeing other people's finds, you know, what they found, even if it's small stuff. You know, people get excited about the stuff they're finding and you have to honor that. You know, you have to respect the fact that they may not be, you know, as far along as what you are in that, you know. And so even when people bring in stuff that's like, okay, it's okay. You know, it's neat to see that they're at least out there and finding stuff and getting
having
excited
fun,
about
which
it.
Is, it's exactly. All about having fun.
It really is.
So, Montana, when you were working on your book, Rockhounding Alaska, how did you find the sites? Did you actually go out and prospect for them or word of mouth? I mean, are these sites that change over time the sort of the list of best sites changes?
I would definitely say for every site that's in the book, I've been to about five that either didn't work out, turned out to be illegal, someone chased me off their land, you know, the road wasn't there. So it involved a lot of exploring, but really the groundwork was already laid by the rock clubs. So, I mean, people know where to find stuff in the state, and they generally get that information off geologic surveys, scientific publications, USGS there in Anchorage. So, you know, there's a multitude of places that you can comb through and you can find the information that's already been published. But it was already compiled and it was recommended to me to go to certain areas by the rock clubs, particularly in the south. When I set off into the northern part of the state, and the southeast, of course, it was a lot more difficult. So it's just a combination of talking to land managers and searching through USGS publications and combing the internet, and
the big social aspect here.
People can be protective.
Yeah. Well, this has been a great topic.
Protective of a site. So
this has been a really good topic. I would, you know, love to learn more, and our listeners can learn more by going to alaskapublic.org and checking out the websites you'll find there, which are going to help you get involved in rock hounding if you want to do it. Philip Elliott from Matsu Rock and Mineral Club, thanks for being with us.
You bet.
Montana Hodges, author of Rockhounding Alaska, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
All right, and I also want to thank Robert Blodgett and David Yesner, who are with us in the first half. Thanks for joining us today on Outdoor Explorer. Grace Bogene is our production assistant. Books our guests. Our producer is Evan Erickson, and I'm your host, Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.